6 months ago.
And so much has happened, and we shot how many episodes, and we're still bubbling, man. But I'm excited about what's coming out.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Me too, absolutely. Actually, I had a random parent at my kid's school who I had forgotten I had talked to about it. He's like, man, I checked you guys out. You know, I subscribed. And I'm like, cool, we have more coming. He's like, all right.
I got this Arabic lady at the vape shop that's like, she's waiting on our next episode.
We have a diverse audience.
Random as hell. Hell yeah, man. But we are back. Another episode of A Professor and a Comedian Walking to a Bar. I'm your co-host, Mike Knight. This is my co-host.
Hey, I'm Sapir Vakil. Good to see everyone. Mike, which camera am I looking into?
Whichever one tickles your fancy.
Okay.
Yeah, because this is an important episode, right, gang? We are back with the post-election Professor and a Comedian recap.
That's what we're doing. That's
coming
what we're
here. From both of our worlds, and we both had to go directly to work and address this
the very next day.
The very next day, man.
Right.
And here's what's crazy about doing a podcast with one of your buddies. Something like this happens, and we've talked like 2-3 times since then. We can't have the conversation we want.
Right.
Because we're like, yo, we got to do this on the pod, man.
That's right. Hold on. Hold that thought.
Now we're just talking about what stocks we got for Christmas.
It feels like it, right? People are kind of right back to business.
But I am immediately, and it's amazing how, because I got a lot going on in my life right now, and I'm like, oh, the whole world is da da da. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about anything that I have going on right now, because everybody is living their own life. The election happened. Everybody's living their own.
People have to kind of pick up and do what they do. I think there's different levels of probably heaviness, I'm sure, you know, but by and large, I see what you're saying. People are just continuing on, right?
Either way it would have went, do you think it would have been the same, like this feeling in the atmosphere? There wasn't a big dust up, there wasn't a big fallout, there wasn't panic in the streets, there wasn't riots, protests that I've seen.
No, you're right. Things have kind of, you know, the traffic in the streets are flowing in the same way. But I feel like actually I heard for the first time this morning Joe Biden's remarks, you know, and I was like, this, you know, this is how it's done, right? So I think in large part the calm and the tranquil atmosphere is heavy, but it's actually credit to the Democratic Party in a sense. Like it's like this is a peaceful transition to power, right? I think that has to be noted. Like people were like, hey, the people spoke and they spoke clearly, and there isn't this sort of, you know, bullshit that we saw in January 6th or any challenges. It's just like, that's in a way that part actually ironically feels good. Like even when, you know, when this massive, in some ways unexpected, like the scale of the victory.
Right. How do you feel about what they did to Joe Biden?
In terms of what?
I love walking you through a corner, bro, because you got to go back to class. that's why I left it open-ended like that, right? Mm. Whatever your perception of how that transfer went from, all right, Joe Biden's running to be president, and next thing you know, boom, Kamala Harris is in there.
He should have left earlier, you know? Mm. I mean, he should have left on his own. He had to be kind of pushed out, and they had to, you know, twist his arm and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, was it the most pretty thing to watch? No, it wasn't, right? I think that, but ultimately he did the right thing, in my opinion. Now, was it a little bit forced? Sure, but it had to be. Right?
A little bit forced. He was like that old uncle at the barbecue having Vietnam flashbacks.
You had to leave, man.
Auntie Juju just had to grab me. I'm gonna take Curtis back to the garage real quick.
That's what it was, and it had to be that way.
That was crazy. But what did you end up having to do the next day?
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So for some context for our viewers, right? So I'm in
You're the professor.
I'm the professor.
I'm the comedian.
And the very next day, so I had class Wednesday morning at 9:30.
For context, by the way, everybody, if you're enjoying the content, really hope you are. We put a lot into this. If you would please take a moment, like the content, subscribe. Tell your friends to tell a friend to tell a neighbor. Hop on board with the thing. We got so much coming with the professor and the comedian. But just for context, you are at Northwestern, which you would classify as a what-leaning kind of school?
I mean, it's a Democrat leaning, it's a left leaning school. That's okay. That's absolutely, it's higher ed. It's academia.
Sure.
I mean, for sure. And we can get into that because it relates directly to part of what.
So you're at work the next morning. Trump is announced, popular vote, the electorate, and the whole nine.
But most importantly, before like top of mind for me in that moment isn't the politics of higher education. I'm more like I'm about to show up in front of 35 undergraduate students.
Interesting, your thought process.
That's where I'm at. So they're ranging from ages, 18 to about 22, right? So that's what I'm thinking about on my way in. I teach this class with my doctoral student, Charles Logan, who's actually he's designing the class, teaching the class with me.
Mm-hmm.
And he was thinking ahead already in the beginning of the semester, like on our syllabus. We were like, oh, this is the day after the election. We didn't know what to expect from the outcomes.
Right.
But what's the day look like? So we were already planning on doing something different anyway in terms of debriefing, connecting the election, whatever, which way it went, to the outcome. But I think personally, I feel bad a little bit because Charles put in some work making a plan for that day.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Logan, shout out Charles
Chaz
Logan.
Chaz Lowe, shout out.
And I sort of, I just went, I kind of just, I think derailed his plan a little bit. And I just stepped, because I was thinking, what is my responsibility to these students? Right, they're coming in. I can't presume that I know.
Were you gonna tiptoe into it or just band-aid right off? Right, let's get into it.
We just went right in.
Yeah,
I didn't even have a plan. I was just as I was driving into work or taking the bus into work, I was thinking to myself, how old were these kids? Right, and I say that with respect, because I have stepdaughters who are pretty much their same age. So I'm looking crazy. At them.
And the kids in your class grew up in a world where a black man could be president.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. And they grew up in a world, I think, where Trump was elected president, right?
So you could say they
grew up in a world where Obama had been elected, where someone who, with white supremacist viewpoints could be elected eight years ago. And it happened. And so I was like, how old were they, right? And so they're young. They're kids. They're preteens, right?
Yeah,
18 to 12. That's they're like 12, 13, 14 years old the first time. So they have some recollection of that. They're in a left-leaning university environment, to your earlier point. You've been to my classes before. It's a good mix of people, different ethnicities,
backgrounds. How are you addressing them?
I just named it. I was like, I came in there. I didn't have a plan, per se.
Sure.
The mood was heavy already.
Mm.
So I come in, I'm seeing the mood, and I was just like, hey, guys, nothing prepares. There was nothing in my preparation as a professor to what to do the day after someone with, at the minimum, fascist-leaning commitments and viewpoints gets elected. So, like, we're here. I'm processing it. How are you guys feeling? Let me tell you a bit about how I'm feeling. And I just kind of went through, like, this morning I called my mother. I'm talking to my wife. She's in tears. I know there's a feeling of doom. I know there's a feeling of gloom, of disappointment. Again, I can't presume where they're at. And I said, but hey, I've been honest with you guys about where I'm at. You know, like I try to make room in this space for multiple viewpoints on things. But you guys, I'm a human. And you guys have been hanging with me for the last, 2 months as your professor. So like, here's how I'm thinking about it. Here's a conversation I had with my 7-year-old son this morning. Who's like, I asked him, like, how are you feeling, to my son? He walked down the stairs. I knew he had already talked to his mom.
Yeah.
He said, I feel nervous. I said, why do you feel? That's a very particular word for a 7-year-old, right? I'm like, you feel nervous? I'm like, why do you feel nervous? He's like, because I remember, Baba, you told me 6 months ago that Trump separated families from their kids.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, the fact that he even held on to that very particular point around family separation. We hadn't talked about that for months.
Yeah.
So I had to reassure him. So I'm telling this to my students. I'm telling the story. First of all, as a dad, I'm like, oh man, my kid feels nervous, and he's thinking about the possibility that the people in power could separate him from.
Sure.
So I'm like, first, I'm reassuring him, right? I'm like, you're a citizen. He was born in Texas. You're okay. So I'm reassuring my kid, but I'm also sharing the story to my students as a way to say, here's the emotional reality for me, but also here's the privilege that I have and my kids have. And it's a recognition that I think I share that to make the point to my students that other people with far less resources who are far more vulnerable to politics are probably feeling this in deeper ways than I am. And how do I both like, okay, shit, this is crazy for me and my family, but also not make it about me.
What are the kids saying? You know what I mean? When you're talking
to them? It opened up. At first, it was quiet. I went on for like 10, 15 minutes. And then I opened it up, and a lot of people shared. Actually, students who were tend to be quiet. Even opened up, shared. People talked about different things.
And are you getting a sense of feel, or people doom and gloom?
Yeah, people were upset, you know. But the other thing I wanted to do was to name the messiness of it, because some students asked me, "So what do you think? Why did the independence?" I was like, "Hold on, like I don't have the answers to like why X, Y, and Z happened, but and that's actually important to name too. And if you know, so it's like we don't know. We can't have these knee jerk reactions. But yeah, there was a sense of a doom and gloom, but also a recognition that the reality is messier. So we had one black student from North Carolina. He talked about his parents being in the civil rights movement. Because I asked students, who did you call this morning? What was the first phone call you had? And he's like, I called my mom. And my mom and my dad are you know, really in their feelings. It's depressing. We have a whole legacy as a family of civil rights participation and this, that, and the other. And then he also named, and I really appreciated this, he's like, but I've always had, he's like, as a black boy, he's like, I've always had privilege of socioeconomic, like upper class family status.
Okay.
He's like, I have cousins in my family who have a much different reality day to day. And so it's different for them. So I'm thinking about them. I had an Ethiopian girl in the class raise her hand and say, all my aunties voted Trump. Right. And I'm processing that. So like, why, you know, and so I was like, thanks for naming that.
Because sure. So when you reality. Say you're processing it, like what do you, how do you mean? Like what is your thought process when you hear something like that? Or just, were there any students in your class, as a matter of fact, that were like, I went the other way?
Nope. None. I mean, now, did they share?
None that admitted. Sure.
Maybe none that admitted.
Right.
Yeah, that's a fair question. Yeah. There could be some. And
because that's taboo right now. You can't be, I don't think, in a fancy place of book learning and be like, yo, I'm MAGA'd out. Like, you can't be on your skateboard through campus.
You're right.
With your MAGA hat backwards.
You're right.
Doing kickflips and Christ airs.
You're right. That's not, if you are, it's not the, it's probably not a comfortable
space. Here's the thing, though, is I think that is kind of what.
Part of the problem?
That's kind of what propelled it, because when somebody has to hide like that, it makes it more, you're more galvanized, I think, right? You're going to find other people of similar minds. And since you're in secret, it makes you feel more impassioned about your movement. Yeah. I think if you feel marginalized,
right?
Because I think it seems like both parties feel marginalized. Any election, it's like, I'm marginalized because this, that. And the other side is, well, I'm marginalized because this, that, whenever you guys are in power. But I don't know.
No, you're right, Mike. If what you're getting at is like conservative viewpoints are a bit marginalized in general in higher ed, I think that's true.
Mm.
It's also true. And I think it's okay to admit that. I think sometimes there's a reluctance to admit that. But it's true, right? It's true.
It's an open secret.
It's an open secret. It's the reality. But now how we sort of make sense out of that and what we do with that is the next step. It's also true that I think the world of higher ed, maybe because of that, because of the disconnect, if we're being honest, we as in the world of higher education, did not see this coming. Right.
Mm.
Which I think is really important to say. Right. And like for me speaking personally, I thought it was 50-50 going into it. I didn't know. I think deep down I hoped and kind of thought that Kamala was going to pull away with a win.
Mm.
She didn't. I was like, oh, shit. And then when I saw the numbers, I saw the damage that Trump did on the popular vote.
Of course.
Cleaning up the House, the Senate. I think the House went.
Can I tell you? It was the. What they call it, the red wave from, they was expecting it like tsunami. In the midterms last year or the year before, and it didn't happen, it happened. I'll tell you what, I think personally, and I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, I think Kamala did exactly what she was going to do from the beginning. Because it was a win-win, I think, on the Democratic side. Because whatever was happening with Joe Biden, sleepy uncle syndrome, He had to get out of there. They got him out of there. And it was so late before the election. If you're going to send somebody on a quote-unquote suicide mission, are you going to send your ninja? Mm. Nah, you're going to send in a capable number two, number three. Some if they would have sent in their number one person with a month and a half, 2 months to run.
Who would it have been? Who do you think their number one
would
have
been? Probably got to go Gavin.
Gavin?
Gavin looked like Clark Kent, bro. I mean, throw some glasses on him. I saw you, Gavin, when you tried to do that crossover turnaround. You tried to do a sham god in China and fell on a little Chinese boy. You can't be messing up basketball play. Obama hit a three cold in church shoes in a crowded auditorium. You tried to do a spin move and fell on a little Chinese boy in China. That might have messed some stuff up. That probably
I don't want him to post me up. But yeah.
Know what I mean? Like they had no time to prepare. I feel like anything that she got out of there, out of the momentum of the, it was just the momentum of the Democratic Party. Like this system in place for this amount of time. I think that's what helped propel her, because for the whole time that she was, you know, that last 4 years, mm-hmm. you didn't really hear much about her. Mm-hmm. So the simple fact that she did what she was able to do in that short amount of time, mm-hmm. that's a win, because she was, mm-hmm. you remember Jeremy Lin
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
on the Lakers?
Yeah.
And out of nowhere, it's like,
I got a lot of Asian friends
everybody's, yeah. everybody's injured. Who we get with? Who?
Right.
From where?
Right.
Didn't he play for Ivy League school? What? Put him in there. We need a warm body for the. And then he went on fire for like up until the playoffs. And then that next once the NBA figured it out, it was like, oh, he can't go right. Da da da. Push him to the. It was.
So you're saying, Mike, that they kind of knew she wasn't like it was known in a sense, like it was anticipated that she wasn't going to do well, or it was a gamble that they were willing to take.
Trump already has so much momentum. He had 4 years of running that he had 4 years to refer to. I did this, that, the last 4 years. Biden looked a little off at the end.
Very off.
So that they were weak. So whoever they would have put in front, it's like, hey, you're going on a suicide mission. You're probably not going to make it out of here.
Let me just say, man, I think she deserves.
I'm going to have to bleep that word out.
She deserves. No, it's okay. I say it's okay.
Have I offended you?
No, I think she did. Like, look, the reality is not only did people not really know who she was,
mm-hmm.
they didn't even have a positive image of her in mm-hmm. general. Right, like even myself, myself included. I was like, "Who?" Like, not
because
really.
She didn't do this,
right? She wasn't known. She wasn't around people, so she had like a slightly negative, I think, image. And then I think she did a great campaign. I think she did her best. I won't blame her at all. But let me get back to the question of higher ed real quick, because the point I was trying to make was that the reality of America, mm-hmm. which I think is on display right now, mm-hmm. however you want to process it, like it's a reality that's pro Trump.
Okay,
right. Lives outside of the imagination of higher ed. People didn't see this coming, and it's partially related to what you said earlier about mm-hmm. like conservative viewpoints not really having a place at the table. I'm not calling for like, you know, a new wave of conservative thought in academia. I think it's okay to have some conservative thought. I like that. And this is part of what I like about comedy, is that there's a more of just an honesty and an embrace about the reality of people's opinions. Yeah. I think people weren't honest. Maybe including the kids in my class. I don't know. I think it is taboo to be right wing, and I feel like we're not connected enough to communities in mm-hmm. higher ed. That's the other point. Coming back to the comedy academia thing, when I look at your world, Mike, you all are connected to, let's just say, Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just start locally, right? Let's compare the institution of comedy in Chicago to the institution of higher ed in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You as a person, as a comedian, as an artist, are connected to the city in a much deeper way than I am as an academic, right? Because when you have a show, I was at your show a couple days ago, you don't know who's walking in the door. And everyone's walking in. It's like, it's a true mix of people. There's a working class nature to it. It's affordable. Let's just start there. It's affordable to go catch a show, right? It's not, who's at Northwestern, right? Mm-hmm. So there's an elitism already off the jump. And I think that elitism has blinded us a little bit in academia to the reality of America. Right? Yeah.
I mean, I can change somebody's mood. You can change somebody's retirement. So they gotta possibly approach it a little bit different. So I went to work. I went to work the next day myself. I was at Laugh Factory. Shout out Laugh Factory. And I knew I had to do the same thing. Like, I have to address it because I was hosting. So every comic coming up.
You didn't set it up. You didn't set Mike. Like, this is, I want the viewers to understand. So, like, it's the very next day. It's the same
day
that I was teaching. Mike has a big show at arguably one of the top venues.
One of the top venues. Yeah.
And it's Wednesday. And I'm looking up the calendar. I'm like, oh, and you had mentioned to me you have a show. So Mike is hosting an 8 p.m. show on Wednesday, the day after the election.
And there was a decent amount of people out there.
And I wasn't sure, because I couldn't catch up with you the day of.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure if Mike was just performing. I'm sitting there. I ordered my drink. I'm like, oh, shit, it's packed. This is nice. It's the day of, right?
Yeah.
It's Wednesday. And boom, they call up Mike as he's the host of the show. I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what were you thinking? How were you prepping for the day of? What was going through your mind?
I kept my mind open. I didn't go with any like hard script in my mind. I was just like, yo, I know I got to do it. I got comics behind me and chances are, you know, they'll probably have something to say on it. So I need to go ahead and pop the bubble, find out where the audience's temperature is at. You know what I mean? Run out there and take the arrows and be like, they over there.
Right. And that's exactly what you did.
Yeah.
You leaned right into it.
But the audience was pretty decent, you know? And we're in a metropolitan city, so I automatically knew, like, it was going to be very similar setup to possibly what your class was going to be, which is a majority of people that was bummed out. And anybody that was actually like, hey, my guy won, they're going to sit there and shut up.
That's kind of how you, was that how you were thinking about the audience? Or did you anticipate a little bit of more of a mix?
Well, I'll tell you what, if there's a difference between hosting and performing, right? Like, if I had a set, I would have went crazy. Oh, I would probably have had some people in there crying, laughing, and I would have had some people walking out because I wouldn't have held back. But as a host, you have a different responsibility. Mm. Me blowing my spot doesn't just affect me. It affects everybody that comes at.
You're creating a vibe.
If I just tank the room, and there's nothing. It's crickets.
But
rustling a receipt and five people walking out, and then I go
right. Our first comic tonight.
Well, coming to the stage is.
Okay, but with that, first of all, I didn't appreciate that until you just said it. So that's a responsibility you have as a host.
Yeah. But because that would have been the same as if you had a guest speaker come in from Harvard,
right?
And then you go up there and be like, "Look, I'm gonna tell y'all, I voted,
right?
I voted for Trump last time and this time.
I'm just letting you guys know.
But anyway, here comes
right.
But here comes Jeremy Chucklehut.
But you weren't even with that. You didn't come across as neutral. You were messing with the audience a little bit.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah,
and so you weren't like, I'm gonna play it super safe.
No, I got a poke.
Right.
Otherwise, I would have been the professor at the bar.
Right.
If I just went up there and said,
let's
take time to process this. Your feelings are valid. Do you feel validated? You little misty eyed. Now you got to go up there and look like, all right. If I know everybody's leaning this way. And I'm gonna go over, you know, I'm gonna hit you with a little crossover, give you some motion over here, then bow, pivot back over there. Hope I don't lose the audience because it's a touchy day.
Tim Hardaway,
and then bring up the next, and then bring up the next person. try and maneuver through that, man. But it was fun, and I talked to one of my comedy buddies that actually performed night of, and he said it was a ghost town. Won't nobody laughing? They had like a couple of shows the night before, and I guess he said it was. Nobody. What's the little cartoon? The little bush.
Mm-hmm.
Just
interesting. Right.
I said nobody was in the mood for nothing.
Yeah,
like they just had their tickets already ready, and then went out and was like, "Nah, this wasn't."
I thought you did a great job of setting the tone. You were messing with them. It was like you had your own set. It seems like much harder to be the host than just to have a set because you're being so responsive to. Members of the audience.
I have more fun. I have not more fun, but I enjoy hosting because it's less pressure.
Okay. And then so we got to tell the audience this. So like you started basically like a running theme joke that was like the sort of which was the every single comedian played on this, which was there was like that white dude sitting in the front.
Didn't I call it though? I was like, yo, you smell like money, my boy.
Mike is getting at this guy, man.
Yeah,
and where I was seated in the audience, I had this like direct view to his face. I was watching, and he was being a good sport, but he was not unaffected.
No.
You guys were, so Mike started.
Anybody that really has money don't like people saying that they got money out loud.
But let me be an academic for a minute and deconstruct it. We're at a comedy club the day after Trump was elected, and the butt of the joke throughout like the 90 minutes together was this, you know, older white gentleman.
Tan sports jacket, white undershirt, and he had that, yo, I got a Corvette button. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he had money.
Like some people do the first two buttons until it gets to the top of the wife beater. He went like the extra two.
He went extra two.
Like that, he was like, yo, I got taco meat and it's tan because I be in Miami like that.
Right. Exactly.
And I was like, oh, and you're the only person in the front row? Welcome to the U show now.
Right. But it's just I'm gonna, again, this is me maybe overanalyzing, but like when the Republicans won, when Trump wins, and then the object of humor, the butt of the joke throughout the night becomes this older white guy from money. It felt like a collective venting a bit. And maybe that's me reading too much into it. Like this is gonna be the kind of humor we're getting at. But it wasn't so obvious. That's the thing that I always notice about comedy is that it's not obvious. I think what we do in academia, either we don't name the elephant in the room at all. So I've been in meetings.
That's a sin. If you're a comedian, that's a sin.
I've seen that. So either we just carry on. We go into a room. And I've had meetings since the election.
Yeah.
Where it's like everyone, this is the most important thing on everyone's mind. And yet we're going to have a 2-hour meeting, literally a 2-hour meeting, doing a bunch of agenda items. And no one's going to even, I mean, these are our colleagues. We're not going to even be like, hey, how you feeling? How's it like? Let's name this thing that's happened in the world. So it's either that extreme or the other extreme, which is like we're going to name it and we're going to sit there and validate everyone. But you guys sort of, I feel like, have a middle ground. You kind of name it, you play with it, you move away from it. Some of the sets, I think some of the sets that night were completely not addressing it, and some were. I think there was a variation.
Yeah. There was some people that definitely just came in there to do their job. There was that one out of town guy that was, he was real, but
which
I mean,
one,
there's, I forget Buddy's name, but he was, but, there was a few people that kind of dipped their toe into it, but it's when it's something like that, something that powerful, like you can't really just meh and get in and get out. Like if you got a set and you're going to talk about that day after, that's basically your whole set. And day after, to have a good 10 minutes on that, solid to go through, or 5 minutes and segue into your other material, best of luck to you.
Right.
So that's another, my job as a host, I imagine one of my jobs, go out there, address it first, and maybe, you know, if I'm a comic and I'm performing that night and the host goes out there and talks about whatever, talks to the crowd, you know, messes with the rich guy in the front. Okay, now I can react to what you just did. Mm-hmm. And it takes a little bit of the pressure off of me because I'm not just bringing it up out the middle of nowhere. Like if you ever, you're married, but go back to the dating life, trying to meet a girl just on the street, that's going to be hard, right? But if you meet a girl through a friend, right, it's that little segue or whatever that helps out. It's the
transition.
Yeah, something like that. So that's the host job. I think is to open as many doors as you can for the other comics to walk through. But no, it's interesting that everybody chose to come to comedy after that.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So my question on that is, what's the I've heard some people talk about Trump as like a gift to comedy, right? You know, I hear like Stephen Colbert, like it's like it's his material, you know, being generated. Now you guys are going to rip on it.
He has a DNA of a comedian. How he talks. I you know, of course I know comedians. The majority of the most successful comedians that I know have the ability to just go and just keep words coming out of their mouth, like it feeds into its own narrative. And I think people are like that in many different avenues of things. Like good podcast hosts, good storytellers, jazz musicians, somebody that can just get there and whatever their instrument is, whether it's their voice, their thing, their, you know, playing basketball, somebody that can just go, it's a versus somebody that's like a counter puncher, right?
Right.
And with Trump, he can just go.
Yep.
Like when he's on podcasts or whatever like that, or if he's in the, they were making fun of it where it was like, yo, at his rallies, he's going like 3 hours because he can just, he could feed off of his own conversation. Put him in solitary confinement. If he ever gets convicted, he'll be fine. He's going to be talking forever. It seemed like Kamala was more of a counterpuncher reactor. She was trying too hard not to say the wrong thing.
Sure, sure. But yeah, no, that's I can see that for sure. My question though is, how do you think the world of comedy, like, is the Trump presidency gonna, you know, in any significant way shape comedy over the next, you know, few months and years?
Yeah, of course.
It will, right?
Yeah, of course. It would have either way. But I think when it comes to Trump, he's so like bodacious. You remember that word? Mm-hmm. Like, he's so out there that it's like, he both of them. Biden has sleepy uncle and Trump is drunk uncle. Mm-hmm. Trump is your drunk, slightly racist uncle that once he has the bottle of Crown Royal half done, he's going to start saying some wild, wild shit. But I've always thought,
like, what else
that it's not a, I always thought it was not a coincidence that typically America goes back and forth. Mm-hmm. You've never seen a 3-term run on one side of the aisle. Mm-hmm. It'll bounce over here, stay over here 4 years, 8 years, bounce over here, stay over here 4 years, bounce back 4 years, bounce back 8 years. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it seems like a good, bad system. Mm.
I think we might be able to say it was inevitable. In a way, given where the country was at.
It would have happened eventually. Yeah, sure. Eventually.
So, okay. So, I mean, I think as we sit here, you know, going back to work, right? I'm back to Northwestern. You're back on the road doing shows. And what's the feeling like for you going into the next stage of work? Because we're still trying to unpack it. Like, it's people are on high alert
in
academia.
I'll tell you what really scares me, not scares me, but what I got my eye open for, and you should have your eye open for it too. Every correction is an overcorrection. Hmm. And I think a lot of, I'll talk about in the comedian side of things, cancel culture had a run, right? And it started off, every correction is an overcorrection. So it started off, hey, a lot of not cool things are being said. That needs to be corrected. And then it went, it flourished, it seeded, it budded, it had fruit, and now it's on the other side. Now it went too far.
Interesting.
Right? And now, boom, it's going the opposite way. And you're going to see, it's going to be the same thing play out. Cancel culture, it's going to go away from that. People are going to start to be more free with their words and their thoughts and their true inner feelings that may not be polite. And then it's going to get toxic towards the end of it. Before too long, people are going to be saying a lot of crazy a lot of craziness is going to be coming out of people's mouths, up to and including comedians. Comedians are going to probably be the front runner because now they're like, wait, dude in the CEO chair is talking like that? Oh, I get to say whatever the fuck I want on stage. We about to go crazy. And it's going to be wild. When it gets to the overcorrection side, it's going to be wild. I'm interested to be a part of seeing what that translates to on campus.
Yeah, on campus is going to be very interesting to see what happens. So I'll remind listeners that J.D. Vance, you know, has made higher education a focus of, you know, as you know, so he said things like professors are the enemy, you know, universities are the enemy, like, and has threatened a variety of specific things to, I mean, and things are already happening, by the way. So
talk about that.
So things are already happening. Whereas, so for example, I'll mention one specific thing. Ted Cruz from Texas, who won again, he oversees a committee that checks, you know, federal funding, right? So the National Science Foundation is one of the key funders of a lot of research in universities. I have a grant from the National Science Foundation many of my colleagues do across universities. Okay. Right? And they've done an audit. Ted Cruz and his committee did an audit of all the, you know, grants that were, you know, issued over the last several years.
Yeah.
And basically we're looking for, you know, a communist ideology, DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And they have been issuing FOIA requests to gather data, information about participants, information about funders. You know,
they want the narc list. They want to find out that. Oh my God, that's like a RICO case.
No, it's real and it's happening. So people are already thinking about what does it mean. And some people get grants from institutions, but depending on what state,
I mean, that's. Hey, who was on the other side? We need a list.
No,
that's actually kind of.
I don't like to be an alarmist, and I think some people are. Yeah. But there's the reality, and there's the reality, right? And
so, wild.
And depending on the state that you are a professor in,
yeah,
you can't. Your university might have policies,
yeah,
that restrict you from even receiving federal dollars to do work. For instance, if your project says something around. Equity, racial mm-hmm. equity, you know, transgender justice, whatever. Those things are flags now, and people have already been watching, and that apparatus is going to be ratcheted up for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that element, and then there's the element. So there's multiple things at play, Mike. Like yeah. there's that piece of it, and then there's the piece before what you mentioned around. There's a tiptoe culture. You can't really be open if you have a conservative viewpoint. The idea of academic freedom has been tested. And debated because of the Palestine and ongoing war in Gaza. So it's a mess. Let me just put it like that. It's a mess. Everyone's on alert. And I think the future of higher ed and universities is being debated and talked about right now. Like what it's going to look like in 3-4 years and how effectively they're going to be able to withstand, you know, the Trump administration's and like what that dynamic is going to look like.
Yeah.
Is all... in dynamic motion. Yeah. So, yeah, it's going
to
be real.
That seems too risky for them to come at schools, though, like that, and just start slashing budgets.
But I think it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And I think the question is how is the world of higher ed going to take up this moment? You know, is it going to continue business as usual? And I'm going to be a little bit reductive here, but so much of the research that happens in universities. As much as I love my profession and my colleagues, I've been also part of conversations where we're like, look, our research needs to be better connected to the realities, right, yeah. of society. And in this moment, what does that look like? So for starters, I hope that political scientists, social scientists, et cetera, get together and say, let's really take seriously and reckon with what happened in this election. Right. What like can we can't have roughshod, knee jerk understandings and takeaways. Right. For instance, people are saying, oh, the Latino vote. Right. Went to Trump. Like, even that's incorrect statistically. Like, okay. I just saw something. Let me pull something up real quick as where we know that there was a shift. So first of all, it's owning the shifts that happened. We know that a lot of
that says something.
It does say something. So I'm just saying that like people need to slow down and take stock. Right. So. Like I told my class that part of what's difficult about this moment, mm-hmm. right, is as someone from the Middle East, my own community, mm-hmm. Iran in particular, but the community of Arab Americans, Iranian Americans, were practically split, right?
Yeah,
there was a shift of black men going towards Trump. The Latino community had a shift, right?
Do you believe the rhetoric about black men not voting for Kamala because she was a woman?
That's actually my point. Is I don't know. I've heard that rhetoric. I don't think it's to believe or not to believe.
What's crazy is there a percentage of any man sure of any race? Of course there is.
Sure.
I don't
how statistically significant that is a question.
Yeah.
So that's actually my point. Is people are already going to have so many theories. People are going to say the Democrats were too pro-Israel. They lost Michigan because they had no spine against. To stand up against Israel. That's one narrative. Another narrative is going to be the exact opposite, right? Yeah. That the Democrats were too, you know, forgiving of the student protesters last spring. Hmm. And that was a backlash. People are going to say black men don't love, you know, black women. And that's going to be, you know, there's going to be so many narratives.
Yeah.
And what I'm calling for is like, I hope my world says, okay, let's own our feelings. Let's own our professions responsibility in this moment and start doing the work to understand. So in 4 years from now, or 2 years from now, we can say we have a deeper understanding of society and what matters to people and why the Democrats lost. There's so many theories we can have, right? We can have so many theories about what the hell just happened. And I hope that the world of knowledge and, you know, academia takes up this moment and rolls up their sleeves and gets kind of pragmatic with it and says, let's figure out what really what really transpired so that we can be of better service. And now, how do you do that without being partisan? That's a challenge.
I don't know if you necessarily have to pick sides every time, but because all the everything that all the issues are already laid out and put under, you know, somebody's side, as soon as you pick an issue, people assume you're on XYZ side. But that's why outside of being in a military family and moving around, I'm glad I didn't grow up in a place where I had to pick a gang, because you pick a gang early and then you find out year two, it's like, I'm not down with that part, man. I didn't know gang meant this, and that. No, man.
So do you feel like you've kind of been, you were raised in a way to have a more of an independence of mind, and you just go issue by issue. But has there been one party?
I was more incubated growing up because I was in a military family. So when you're growing up in a military family, everything is in the environment of the military. I was an American, but I wasn't living in America like that. Even if we were stateside, we was on the base for the most part. I didn't go out and mingle with a lot of civilian kids. And of course, if we were somewhere in a different country and I was growing up, I'm on the base. You go out and
that's interesting, man.
Yeah, you don't mix around with a lot of other people. You're just in the military capsule. I think it's a lot like outside of you, I don't see teachers out and about. And if I do, I don't know them. You know what I mean? Like cops, I imagine police officers and families, they all stick together.
Right.
UFC fighters and families. You know what I mean? There's a group of musicians that only stay in their musician world.
Right, right.
So it's the same with the military thing. So a lot of the military has the biggest budget forever, always. I mean, like whatever was going on with the economy and all those things when I was growing up, they weren't necessarily the top issues that were being spoken about in my household. In my household, it was like, what blew up in what country? And my pop going, hey, I'll see you in about 8 months. Love you. You know what I mean? So it was similar, but different.
And that's interesting because as a family from Iran, like questions of foreign policy are probably top of mind when politics come to play.
Right? Yeah.
A lot of other things will be discussed, immigration, you know, equity issues, social, whatever. But the question of, you know, especially with Iran in the news every single day.
Have you talked to any of your Iranian family post-election?
Yeah, of course.
What are they saying?
I mean, it's
I think Muslims as a whole kind of started. I think a little bit of a lot of groups kind of crossed over from traditional.
A lot of Iranians crossed over. So Iranians in general demographically have been democratic leaning pretty strongly. Like I'm not sure what the numbers are, but I think it's been like 60-70% historically. This election, I'd be curious to know what the polls are, but my sense is that it's more split. And so but the Iranians are going, there's a group of Iranians, let me just be plain about it. There's a group of Iranians that go for Trump because they believe that the Republicans broadly, but Trump in particular, is gonna free them from the tyranny of the Islamic Republic. That they're gonna stand up to the Islam, you know, that their analysis is, I mean, and Trump actually kind of sees this narrative, right? He was like, look, the reason why the war on Gaza is happening is because Iran got strong under Obama.
Yeah.
And under because of that, you know, fortitude, they're getting, you know, overconfident,
yeah.
and they're messing around in the Middle East. They're funding Hezbollah, you know, they're funding Hamas, and like Iran is the problem, right? From a particular geopolitical lens, Iran is a problem. So you got to deal with Iran. And people in the diaspora, Iranians who want nothing more than to see the end of the Islamic Republic, they're like, yeah, What did that dude say? He said he's going to deal with Iran. Deal with Iran. Now, does that mean drop bombs on the country and kill our own family? Maybe.
Yeah.
And so that's the part where I'm like, have you guys lost your minds? Like the threat of war is real. Like, and under a Republican administration, there's a very real scenario where Israel aided by the United States. I mean, we were already on the brink.
Yeah.
And with all the restraint of Harris and Biden, and so what does it mean to be on the brink? Gaza is on the brink of I mean, it's not on the brink. Gaza is in the midst of horror and chaos. And what does it mean now to have Trump? Am I to believe that Trump is going to come and stand up to everyone and everyone's going to just fall in line and everything's going to be peace in the Middle East?
No. He has so much pressure on him because at the end of his campaign and his, I'll get rid of all the wars. I'll get rid of, you got to slice the cake and move the pieces to the side and then bring them back together. I'll get rid of all the wars. There'll be no more war. I'll get rid of, Russia will be done. Russia will be done in a moment. The day I get in office.
That's a pretty good Trump impression.
Here's the thing though, is you got to deliver on that now, my boy. Like all this happened. Here's a lot of, I think for me, now that it's happened, Now that he's been elected, right? That you talked a lot of stuff. You talked a lot of stuff about Russia, Ukraine. You said day one it's over. Mm-hmm. We know what's going on with Israel, Palestine, and now Israel, Lebanon, Israel, Iran, Israel all day with everybody. You got to figure that out. Right. We're talking like first week and a half. I haven't heard nothing from North Korea, but you got to figure that out. Right. Why are they being so quiet? Right. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think North Korea was talking about sending troops over to Russia.
Here's the thing, Mike. You would think that's what he needs to do. But
I don't think people let him off the hook this time. Really? As business as usual, politics be what it is. Because he's not... Now, here's the thing. He won the popular vote. He's a popular figure. He's not popular. Mm-hmm. Drunk Uncle is fun as fuck at the barbecue, but you don't want to see him at the when he calls you at 12:30 in the morning. You're like, I ain't got $80 for this dude.
That's a good point.
You know what I mean? I don't want him just popping up at my kid's volleyball game because he's gonna make a scene. He's gonna show up with dirty shoes and sweatpants and no underwear. Like he's not a popular. He's a popular figure.
Right.
He's such an entity. He's such a thing amongst themselves that Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. You didn't want Michael Jackson to hang out with you at a drive-thru in a van with your family, but you want to see Michael Jackson when he was alive. You know what I mean? He's a what? This is that's a person with you know like blood like mine. That's crazy. Somebody can end up being that, but he's not him. He's not popular.
It's actually important to underscore also for our listeners. Couple quick rough statistics. So he actually got less. I think 2 million less votes from his own supporters this time than he did 4 years ago. And Kamala Harris got something bogus, like 12 to 13 million less votes than I think Biden got when he won.
Because she didn't do this.
Right.
And by this, I don't mean general podcast. I mean our podcast.
Our in particular.
You should have came here. As a matter of fact, we still got a seat for you. Kamala, if you want to come by, Professor Nigga, PCWB, come check us out.
Come check us out.
We can reignite you for 28.
This is what it is, man. So we're gonna unpack this further in the next couple episodes we got coming up. One in particular, just want to highlight it and get people excited about Professor Juan Carrillo, who is going to come to us. He's a professor at Arizona State University. He focuses a lot of his research on Latino men, and so we're gonna talk to the doc about Arizona and Latino men, and we're gonna be nuanced about it because I think as I was saying earlier, I think it's important to hold on to like look, there have been these demographic shifts amongst people of color, right? That's true, but this is the stat I was gonna pull up real quick. I'm just as a preview of the conversation we're gonna have in the next one. So when people say the majority of Latino men went, that's actually not factually correct. So the recent data that I'm looking at is this disaggregated that data by country of origin. So if you look at Mexico, Puerto Rico, Cuba, Central America, South America, the only group amongst that population that was in the majority for Trump were the Cubans. right? So that's important. I didn't know that until literally last night when I saw this data come through. And it actually shifted something in my own processing of the
minute. Coming from communism, huh?
Right. I mean, you know, the Cubans in Florida have always tilted Republican.
Yeah.
But like, so Mexican, Puerto Rican, Central American, it's different by country of origin. There's nuances to it. That's why the professors are going to be invited in, and we have to have a sense of humor about the whole thing.
Yeah.
I'm in awe, man, of how you did your thing the day after.
I'm in awe of you to be able to go in there and handle those kids like that. And you don't necessarily have comedy to fall back on. I mean, you could be humorous, but you got a real mission going on in there. So I salute you for tackling that, bro.
Appreciate it, man. Definitely, it's an exciting time. I take it with seriousness.
Yeah.
But also try to just, you know, be a human and then take some time off and come see some comedy. And I live in Chicago. So I'm like, if it's Wednesday night, the kids are in bed, you know, I ask wifey, I'm like, do I got permission to step out tonight?
Yeah, yeah.
She's like, you going to see Mike? I'm like, hey, go ahead.
That's what's up, man. I get wifey pass. Salute.
So that's what we're doing. Thank you to our listeners. Everyone hang in
there.
Thank
you. And again, please don't forget to like, share, subscribe. The likes really help out. So if you could take a moment, drop a like for us. And I didn't mean to cut out your outro like that.
No. It's
we got good. New episodes coming up, man. I got some tremendous comics on deck. We got some episodes about to drop that we already got in the can. And this time around, we're full blast. So we're not going to stop dropping once we get to dropping.
Yeah, keep tuning in and let us know if you like what we're saying or don't like what we're saying. We're open to feedback.
Yeah.
And thank you for listening. Appreciate y'all.
Hey, PCWB, I'm Mike Knight.
Sapare Vakil.
Peace.